Pull up a chair, right now. If you're anywhere near East Central Wisconsin, you can hear it. That low rolling thunder that isn't weather, it's radial engines and turbines and home builds stacked up over Lake Winnebago, all of them pointed at one little city that turns into the busiest airport in the world for 1 week every July. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, and this week the whole world of flying comes to Oshkosh, Wisconsin, for the Experimental Aircraft Association fly-in. 500,000 people, 10,000 airplanes, and every single one of them lands at a field called Whitman Regional Airport. Now, most folks taxi past that name on the ATs and never think about it. They hear Whitman, and they figure it's just another airport named after some county commissioner. It is not. That name belongs to a man, a small, stubborn, bespectacled genius from Wisconsin who spent more than 60 years proving that you did not need money or a big factory to fly faster than the men who had both. And today I want to tell you his story, standing right here on the field that carries his name, surrounded by the airplanes he'd have loved. Before I get rolling, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, that's what we do here, so go check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, Sylvester Joseph Whitman, born in 1904, out in the Wisconsin countryside near Byron. Everybody called him Steve. He was a little fella, barely over 5 feet, and he had eyesight so poor that when he first tried to get a pilot certificate, the examiners didn't want to give it to him. Bad eyes, small frame, farm kid with no money. By every measure the world used back then, Steve Whitman was the last man you'd bet on to become one of the fastest pilots alive. He learned to fly in the 1920s, the barnstorming years, when a young man with more nerve than sense could buy a war surplus Jenny and go make a living scaring crowds at county fairs, and Whitman did exactly that for a while. But he wasn't really a showman at heart. He was a builder, an engineer without a degree. A man who looked at an airplane and immediately started thinking about how to make it cleaner, tighter, faster. In 1931, the little airport at Oshkosh needed a manager. Steve took the job, and he would hold it for the better part of 40 years. He ran that field. He fixed airplanes there, he taught people to fly there. And in the back of the hangar, he built racers. Now here's where it gets interesting. In the 1930s, air racing was the biggest show in the country. Bigger than baseball, some years. The national air races out in Cleveland drew crowds in the tens of thousands, and the pylon racing was dominated by big money. GBs, Howard's aircraft, airplanes with enormous engines built by teams with real budgets. Steve Whitman showed up with something he built himself, in his own shop on a manager's salary. He called the first one Chief Oshkosh, a tiny low-wing monoplane, painted up bright, with a wing so short and so small, it looked like somebody had forgotten to finish building it. The thing looked wrong, it looked dangerous. Other pilots laughed, then it flew. Picture the scene. Cleveland, late summer. The air thick and hot and smelling of castor oil and high-octane fuel, the grandstands packed, and down low, right down, on the deck, screaming around the pylons at speeds that made no sense for an engine that size, comes this little home-built out of Wisconsin Whitman flying it like he was wearing it, wingtip practically dragging the grass on the turns. He was beating airplanes that cost 10 times what his did. Later he'd rebuild and rename that airplane. He called it Buster. And Buster became a legend. Over the years Whitman refined it, re-engined it, kept squeezing more speed out of that impossibly small airframe. He understood something the big budget teams sometimes forgot. That drag is the enemy, that every strut, every wire, every square inch of frontal area is a tax you pay in speed, and he was ruthless about cutting that tax. He built a bigger brother too. A racer he named Bonzo, a meaner, faster machine meant to run with the unlimited class, the big iron, and Bonzo could run. Whitman took that airplane to the Thompson Trophy, the premier closed course race in America, and he ran up front against the heaviest hitters in the sport. This little half-blind farm kid from Byron, Wisconsin. Now I want you to understand what kind of pilot it took to fly these things. There were no simulators, no fancy instrumentation. You strapped into a cramped wooden and steel and fabric machine with a big engine bolted to the nose. You firewalled it, and you flew around pylons at rooftop height in a pack of other airplanes doing the exact same thing. Men died doing this. Good men. Every season the sport took somebody. Whitman flew it for decades and kept walking away. Because he wasn't reckless. That's the thing people miss. He looked like a daredevil, but he was an engineer first. He knew exactly where the edge was because he'd built the airplane that defined it. But here's the part that ought to matter most to us, to the folks who fly ordinary airplanes. Steve Whitman's biggest gift to aviation wasn't a trophy. It was a spring back when he was building those racers. Landing gear was a heavy, complicated, draggy business. And Whitman came up with something beautifully simple, a tapered leaf of spring steel, one clean flexing bar that absorbed the shock of landing with no oil, no struts, no moving parts to fail, light, cheap, nearly indestructible.
If you have ever flown a Cessna 150, or a Cessna 172, or a whole lot of other light airplanes, you have landed on Steve Whitman's idea. That flat spring steel main gear, Cessna licensed the concept and put it under tens of thousands of airplanes. Student pilots have been bouncing those things onto runways for 70 years, and every one of those landings traces back to a racer's shop in Oshkosh. That's the mark of the man. He wasn't just fast. He was smart in a way that outlived him by generations, and he never stopped. That's what gets me. Whitman kept designing. He built a two-seat home built called the Tailwind, a fast, efficient little airplane that folks still build in their garages today. He kept racing into his 70s, into his 80s, setting speed records in his own designs when most men his age had long since hung up their headsets. In 1969, the folks at Oshkosh did the right thing. They renamed the airport in his honor, Whitman Field. The place he'd managed and flown out of for most of his life now carried his name over the gate. And then the fly-in came. The Experimental Aircraft Association had started up in 1953, founded by Paul Poberesny and a handful of homebuilders in a basement down in Milwaukee. Regular guys who believed you didn't have to be Boeing to build an airplane, that you could weld it up in your own garage and fly it. The convention bounced around a couple of places, got too big for them, and in 1970 it landed at Oshkosh, at Steve Whitman's Field. Think about how perfect that is. The world's greatest gathering of people who build their own airplanes, who believe in doing it yourself, who believe that ingenuity beats a big budget, and it comes to rest at the airport named for the man who did exactly that, who beat the rich teams with something he made himself in the back of a hangar. They didn't plan it that way, but they couldn't have chosen better ground. Steve Whitman flew almost to the very end. In 1995, at 91 years old, he was still flying an airplane he had built with his own hands. He and his wife Paula were killed in a crash down in Alabama that spring. The aviation world lost him at 91, still active, still building, still flying, which, if you have to go, is not a bad way for a pilot to be taken. Doing the thing he'd done his entire life. Now here's the piece that closes the loop, that first great racer buster. The little airplane that shouldn't have won and won anyway. It didn't get parted out or left to rot in a barn. It hangs today in the National Air and Space Museum, in the Smithsonian Collection, up among the most important airplanes this country ever produced. A home-built racer from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, hanging in the same building as the Spirit of St. Louis and the Wright Flyer, and right here at home. The Experimental Aircraft Association's own museum, right on the field, keeps his memory and his machines alive. You can walk in out of the July heat, out of the crowds and the flight line noise, and stand in front of the work of the man whose name is on the airport you flew into, the racers, the story, the spring steel gear. All of it preserved so that some kid dragging his dad through the museum this week can look up at a tiny bright airplane and start to wonder what he might build in his own garage. That's the whole point of this place. That's why we come. Because Oshkosh isn't really about the big new jets on the ramp, or the air show acts, or the vendors. Underneath all of it, it's a monument to a simple, stubborn, beautiful idea that an ordinary person with a good mind and a set of tools can build something that flies, can build something that flies faster and better than what the experts said was possible. Steve Whitman proved that with bad eyes and no money and a wing the size of a barn door hinge, and the airport where 500,000 of us gathered this week to celebrate flying carries his name for a reason. So this week, when you hear that ATIS, or you taxi past the sign, or you're sitting in the grass watching the arrival stream in over Fisk, tip your hat to old Steve, the little man who went fast. My thanks this week to the Experimental Aviation Association and the good folks at their aviation museum, and to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, where Buster still hangs, for keeping this history where the rest of us can find it. You can find us anytime at radiohangar.com. For now, I'm going to go stand on the flight line and listen to those engines a while longer. If you're at Oshkosh this week, walk that museum. Look up at the little racer. And remember whose field you're standing on. This is Tail Dragger, Blue Skies.